Hi everybody, welcome back to our Chat with a CISO podcast. Thank you very much for joining us again. Today, I'm very lucky to have Neil Davidson, who is the CTO for Morningstar in EMEA, joining us from his lovely on-brand London offices.
Always on brand, always on brand.
Thank you very much for joining us, really, really appreciate it. So, as we kind of said before, and as I do most of the intros here is, you know, I've been out of cybersecurity effectively for a good few years, kind of come back in the last year, had a lot of chats with CISO security leaders, etc., as well as kind of industry leaders, which kind of expands into CTO and CIO kind of roles. And having chats like I used to do before, and you know, working with these type of C-level leaders, I just noticed a lot of bits of change, and I'm grabbing all this insight to myself, and be really, really good to share that out. So that's the main reason for this, is to share some insight, do a little bit of community knowledge sharing, and then, you know, build a bit of a community and a bit of a feel around, you know, shared knowledge, shared help. And some people on here have offered to mentor and to support other people as they come up in their careers. So yeah, the whole purpose of this. And and you and I kind of met through, I say a mutual friend, but more kind of like work friend, work colleague for yourself, but a guy that I play a bit of football with, and Stu, who was on the podcast a while ago. You're kind of in a similar position to him. I kind of saw him at one of the events, and I think you were in the front row, and was jokingly saying if Chris was sat there in mine, I'd be absolutely bricking it. But
he did well, actually. I did my very best to catch his eye and put him off. Very unprofessional, but what can I say? He's absolutely a seasoned pro. It's been an absolute joy watching him flourish in his career. Remarkable.
Well, on that note, I'd probably say where you've got to is not too bad yourself. Would you did you want to maybe share a little bit around, you know, where you've got to, what you're kind of doing now, what kind of, you know, we were joking before, what CTO of EMEA kind of really means. And the main part of this podcast will be looking, we'll do the usual, you know, what have you seen over the last couple of years, what are your thoughts on the future, and then a topic which I think we'll focus on, you know, as a CTO, how do you work with the CISO function, and how does security kind of cross over? You know, if anyone's then looking to get into a CTO, what would your advice be later down the line? We can follow that process if that's okay.
Sounds perfect. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, first thing to say, despite the title of the podcast, I'm not a CISO, so disclaimer, don't at me. But hopefully I get a chance to maybe give things, you know, maybe a different slant or a bit of a different perspective from some of your other guests. So I'm a full-time geek. I started out, I've got about, I suppose, 25 years of industry experience now. I studied computing science at Glasgow University, moved to London for my first job, a graduate role, basically because my mate was moving down and said, why don't we move down together and get a flat and have a bit of fun down there, and sounded good. So that was the kind of the depth of thought that I put into my career at that point. However, I've gone from there, and I joined an investment bank. That was the graduate role, and then I've gone on to spend my entire career, all 25 or so years, in financial services technology, mostly with investment banks, until my current role, or my current employer, Morningstar, still in the financial services space, but with a slightly different perspective on things. So I should introduce Morningstar, not necessarily a household name in the UK at least. We are a global company founded in Chicago, and we are one of the world's leading providers of data research and analytics in the investment product space. So that's things like funds, open-end funds, mutual funds, ETFs, or exchange traded funds, things like equities, fixed income, anything that you can invest your hard-earned money into to try and generate a return. And our North Star, our mission, is to empower investor success. So when the investor succeeds, we succeed. And it's a mission that I get a lot of satisfaction from. And I think we do good things in that space. We've also got, that data and analytics is delivered through various data deliveries, various software deliveries, APIs, feeds, You know, however we can get our hands or get our data rather into the hands of investors, we will do.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have a number of, I guess, parallel businesses. So there's a wealth management arm that provides investment services, obviously based off that great data and research and analytics. It's an index business where we generate indexes as an alternative to some of the more established players. There's a credit ratings arm. And there's a sub-entity called PitchBook, which is focused on the private market. So very much like a mini Morningstar almost, but focused on that private markets, VC, PE, M&A, et cetera.
Yeah, I've heard of PitchBook quite a bit from my kind of work and support, you know, helping startups and like, and that's been, yeah.
It's quite a
good product.
Yeah, we were a major shareholder originally, and then bought them outright in 2016. I did the technical due diligence actually on that acquisition.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just gone from strength to strength. It's a phenomenal product with a very, very loyal user base.
Yeah.
So my role, it covers, yeah, as you've mentioned, it's I'm the CTO for EMEA. So I have it's a fairly complicated structure in some ways, but I have my remit covers all the technology staff that are based for Morningstar in EMEA, and that's everything really from product engineering and people delivering for our client facing technology at one end through infrastructure, be that network infrastructure, office infrastructure, things like AV. Anyone who works on that in the region, then right through to our end user technology. So that's, you know, laptop deployment, service desk, our operating system engineering and device management and rollout and all that sort of thing. So it's a really, really broad role. And then project-wise, it can be things like running our data center migration, so where we've exited, say, on-prem data centers and migrated workloads to the cloud. Mm-hmm. Spans multiple teams, obviously impacts the region heavily, so I'll be very hands-on and kind of run and lead those types of programs.
Yeah.
I mentioned acquisitions, doing tech due diligence on some of our potential acquisitions. We mentioned PitchBook. There was another major one that I did more recently. Things like making sure the team are in the right place in terms of location, getting the right support in terms of upskilling and
mm-hmm.
Any gaps that they need to fill in terms of broadening their own career. And then I'd say more recently, I've taken a far greater interest in things like DEI or EDI or you know, whichever way you order your letters in the acronym. But I run an employee resource group or an ERG called Allies, which is a space for people who don't necessarily identify with, you know, a protected characteristic or a minority, mm-hmm. to get involved in DEI and try and make a difference and lend our support to the other groups and help with events and education and amplify their voices. So I get a lot of value from that.
Nice. What got you into doing that? I didn't know that. It's just something you kind of a collective did, or is it something that you kind of felt passionate about and just wanted to kind of help and support?
Yeah, it was exactly that. I think myself and a couple of others, so we kind of jointly launched it in both Chicago and EMEA at the same time with some colleagues. And it was just, I think no surprise that it was probably founded or started by a collection of white, sort of middle-aged, relatively middle-class technologists who identified that, you know, that technology in particular can be a hard industry for minorities to break into and succeed in and flourish in. And you know, there's obviously issues with the supply of talent and where are we going and seeking talent and that sort of thing. So it was born out of that and then has just grown a little bit to really be a voice and a supporting help for any of our colleagues across the organization. It just gives us a space to be involved in the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And try and influence some positivity rather than just be on the outside of it. So it's been great. I've really enjoyed it over the past, crikey, 4 years, 5 years now, I suppose.
Cool.
And then so there's that side of it. I've also got really heavily involved in mental health and promoting good mental health. Trained as a mental health first aider at the back mm-hmm. end of 2022. Which has been really rewarding for me. And then things like speaking on internal panels and really just trying to normalize the conversation around mental health and make people feel more comfortable about just talking about how they're doing with their friends or their colleagues or their boss, or reaching out and getting the support that they need to get through whatever they're dealing with. So a lot more time and energy has gone into causes like that in recent times as well, which is super valuable for me.
Definitely with all the changes, you know, post-pandemic, and also going through that experience, it's a lot for the mind to take, to be switching the way you're working. And I've seen a massive spike that my wife works in that kind of industry. It's just gone through the roof. So yeah, the more and more people can do to support each other and kind of, as you say, normalize it and put those structures in place is massively needed, because we're kind of talking beforehand about remote working and working in offices and how people kind of transition into work a bit more in office now versus before. Yeah. Everyone really was raving, it's great to work from home, wouldn't want to work in an office full time anymore. And now people are kind of moving back to that 3 or 4 days a week sort of thing in office and actually seeing the value from it. It's just, it's interesting to see how that impacts different people's mental state. And
yeah, for sure. And depending, you know, it could really be either a blessing or a curse, I think, depending on how you naturally are as a person. If you're more introvert, suffer from anxiety, yeah, sure, the commute and being in the loud, busy office is maybe not ideal, but equally, just social interaction is such a positive thing. So how can we just support and facilitate our colleagues getting the best from that? It's something that we talk about a lot.
Lovely, that's really nice. I was going to say, what have you kind of seen over the last couple of years? And, you know, we're talking, you know, from a CTO perspective, but this podcast is quite focused around security. But I'd love to get your thoughts on, we kind of dabbled on a few bits there, but how things kind of progressed over the last couple of years and what sort of trends are you seeing that's going to impact, you know, your role, the business and kind of, you know, security is part of technology, right? When I first got in, the CISOs didn't exist. It was just, it's all IT directors and CIOs. And then, you know, as it become more important, cybersecurity kind of become more and more important, those roles kind of come out of that. So yeah, I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think, so thinking about it with a security lens and just actually building on your point, I think one of the most striking things in recent years has been the fact that security, cybersecurity or InfoSec has really moved front and center as a business imperative. Mm-hmm. And I see that, you know, you see that with the sort of the rise of the CISO, and there's some interesting stats published recently about how many, or what, as we move forward in time, what percentage of CISOs will have direct kind of board level contact and recognition. And that's obviously growing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I see it firsthand with, responding and dealing with RFPs or due diligence questionnaires, you know, clients, either existing clients or potential new clients that want to work with us, the majority of their questions will be around our security posture, what do we do, what do we have in place, and you know, all the things that wrap around that. And it's really telling. It's really telling when you get some of these requests for information or these questionnaires, how much of it is focused around data sovereignty, data protection, physical security, cyber security. So you can tell just from those alone how much it has become, and especially when a lot of our customers might be in regulated environments, whether that's banks, insurance companies, pension companies, etc. Mm-hmm. So they obviously have a responsibility, and there's some regulation that means that as a third party supplier that they have to, you know, give us a proper vetting. So I think that's really noticeable and a positive change. The more it is front and center, that will lead to more focus, more investment, you would expect. So that's a positive thing.
Well, you're saying that you as a business, you know, I'm guessing your kind of business biggest asset is the data that you create, right? And cybersecurity and data protection, it's all about protecting that data and securing that with an environment as a supplier to some of the higher, you know, more regulated businesses. Then I can imagine that being on any sort of engagement you have, to make sure that you'd probably be one of the top 10 suppliers that they need to make sure, you know, as part of that supply chain, are as secure, if not securer than them sometimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, our data really is our IP. So protecting that's our crown jewels. So protecting that is super valuable. We take our client data responsibilities obviously very, very seriously. So yeah, all that is super important. The next thing in terms of trends and recent trends, I guess, is just the change from security being something that you do at the end of a project, which is, you know, if I go back to my sort of 25 or so year career, it felt like that was it was in that realm. Now with
the last minute security, so
yeah, and the bit that is we've got to do that. But now with SSDLC and shift left, I mean, that's really changed. I think a lot of that I would trace back to maybe the popularity of cloud, and really that forces us to do things differently. I mean, for a start, there's so many more possible vulnerabilities and attack vectors, but also I think it comes a little bit with the sort of demarcation of more traditional roles within the software development lifecycle. Used to be very, very, very kind of clearly demarcated, I suppose, that you had your product team or your engineering team that built the thing, the product, and then you had your infrastructure team. So it was kind of anything that was like 10 and maybe operating system down was their realm. Everything that was software installed and either third party or bespoke software was the product team responsibility. Then maybe you had the security team that handled your firewall and your reverse proxy and whatever it was. Mm-hmm. These days with cloud and DevOps and DevSecOps, that's all just munged together. You know, these days engineers need to know about WAFs and I'm using an AOB or an ELB, or, you know, I'm having CloudFront, or, you know, whichever vendor you use, am I having a CDN, and what the, you know, how's my traffic going to be managed? So there's a need, there's a really unarguable need for I think the engineering teams to be more security aware, and bring that much, much earlier into the process.
Yeah.
I think another change, and actually this is a good example of it, is just the willingness, that kind of community generation, the willingness to share war stories, the willingness to share learnings and be open and transparent about vulnerabilities or breaches or whatever it may be. I think there used to be the case that people were much more of a closed shop. Maybe it was they need to sort of protect reputation, or they need to keep things in house. But it just feels to me that there's a far greater willingness and openness to realize that collectively we're stronger. Mm-hmm. The good guys, if we get together and everyone's trying to solve the same problems and fix the same things, protect against the same bad actors. So the more that we can share and be transparent and help each other, the better. And, you know, things like the community that you're building with these podcasts and other information sources is great. There was a fantastic paper published a month or two back by the British Library, which if anyone's not read it, they should definitely go out and find it, a sort of white paper based around their experience. They suffered, you'll remember, a pretty significant breach, mm-hmm. knocked them off for quite a while. And they've been really, really open and transparent about why how the attacker got in, what caused it, the things that they wish they'd done, what they're doing now. So again, really valuable sources of information for people to learn from, you know, hold a mirror up and reflect on their own environment and mm-hmm. Where can I learn and implement things from their experience. So that's another another big change.
I was going to say, on that point, I think it's very, very necessary for that, because the bad actors who are kind of driving a lot of these incidents, right, are the ones that collaborate a lot anyway. So
right.
for one side to be collaborating and the other side to be you know separate and disconnected, it's a little bit kind of unfair advantage, right? Like
level the playing field.
Yeah, put it into sports, right? You've got the one sports team who's really attuned to each other and working together, and then the other ones where everyone's just trying to score.
Running around, yeah.
Yeah, makes me think of some of the five-a-side, six-a-side games you play occasionally. Probably gel together sometimes, people just like the ball.
Yeah, I hear you.
no names included on that. But, yeah, I love that fact that
your phone will be going in a minute. Like, are you talking about me? Is that me?
Yeah. But I think it's great on that, and like, you know, as much as we can give back, and you know, I've started doing some presentations talking about some of the things in the past that I've worked on projects to kind of share with people of, you know, what to do and how to think about things. And you know, I see people, you know, obviously we're a pen testing company, and we do have other bits and pieces as well, like instant response training and stuff. But you know, the instant response things that I've been on, how I've seen that happen, and what people have learned from it, and you know, the scenarios people in, I think just then sharing that with other people is
right,
is helpful, because they may not have seen. And sometimes they're like, oh wow, how did that happen? Or, oh, why did that happen? Obviously anonymize things, but you know, it's a lot of it is around just people just trying to do the best, and sometimes people just doing nice things, especially when you look at social engineering engagements you do, like people get fell down for just being nice, like holding the door open for someone, for example. He's just like, well, that's what any natural human would do, but
such an uncomfortable thing if somebody's coming up behind you to stop them and say, can I see your badge? Sorry, I don't know you. It just goes against every human instinct. But yeah, I mean, it's you have to do it. And that, you know, the education and supporting people to understand that is really important.
I was going to ask a bit of a cheeky question. No, we didn't kind of plan this, but have you got any war stories that you've shared before, or that you could share at all, that even in previous places it can be anonymized and stuff? But
I suppose one, I always thought it's not necessarily security related directly, but it's certainly around the whole kind of space of resiliency.
Yeah.
But I in my past worked for a bank, an unnamed bank. And I always used to have this theory that you could tell how serious an issue or a problem was by how many people were stood up, right? So if I look over and you know, you're sat down and there's somebody looking over your shoulder and you're typing away furiously, it's a fairly minor thing. If you're sat down typing away and there's 10 people around your desk, that's serious, right?
Yeah.
So one afternoon, I remember being, you know, on a big floor with many hundreds of people, and started kind of slowly. Somebody went, "Oh, you know, is your F drive accessible or whatever?" And, "Oh no, is your email working?" "No, that's not." And then within about 5 or 10 minutes, I looked, and everyone on the entire floor was stood up.
Oh wow!
And I was like, "Okay, this is bad. I've not seen this before." And it turned out what had happened was that some poor maintenance engineer was in the data center, which was probably in the building at that point. This is, you know, many, 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 many years ago.
Yeah.
And had cut through the wire that led to the big red data center off button, which had the impact of turning the data center off.
Yeah.
So that was my first experience of a really wholesale, widespread outage. I mean, this was the entire bank was out.
Mm-hmm.
So people were running about getting, at this point, it was the black sort of almost like medicine bag, which was the DR plans, being dispatched to the DR site, ready to go and try and get the backup systems up, which in those days probably weren't as well tested as maybe they are now, or as well architected and not scoped or sized and you know, like the production environments. So the good news, and the cutting the long story short, is that, you know, everything worked out all right, obligations were met and lessons were learned. But yeah, it was a remarkable day when literally every system in the organization was down effectively.
But then just a kind of just a genuine human kind of mistake there, that there's no intent behind it.
No, poor and guy just doing his job and clipped the wrong wire. And I mean, I don't even know, maybe he's got no idea how serious it was. I suspect he probably does, but yeah, that was quite a day.
Blissfully unaware would be quite a funny store if that was the case.
Just going about his day, happy times.
So any other kind of like trends in that you kind of seen over the years or anything future?
Yeah, I think the other thing I would probably mention is just I really like when things like, and zero trust, I think, is a really good example. Almost like these really disruptive ways of thinking about things. So, and zero trust is the example. I'm a big fan of it. I think it's a brilliant concept. But it is disruptive in and of itself. You know, there used to be this notion that if my perimeter was safe, then I'm in good shape. And if the perimeter was breached, then, you know, you're in less good shape, but, you know, it will be what it will be. And then something like zero trust comes along and just rips that up and says, no, let's not think about it that way. Mm-hmm. Let's make every single action, every request, every point-to-point, every bit of communication across our network, you know, let's double check that you're allowed to do this. And it's just a radical shift in thinking, but it's infinitely more secure, you know, in the ways that we all understand in terms of stopping lateral movement of an attacker or bad actors internally, there are malicious actors internally, and so it's just a phenomenally strong concept, but it is such a change. It's like I say, it used to be the case that you would protect your, you know, steadfast in protecting your perimeter, but, you know, if somebody was in, they were in, and things were. And actually, going back to the British Library example the document that I talked about before, that's quite a big point of their story, which is once that person was in and they got in through some, it was like a terminal server that was needed for some legacy thing, and, you know, you can fill in the rest of the blanks. But once that person was in, they were in.
Yeah.
And really was able to move around and impact almost anything they wanted to. So, So moving away from these you know, once were the kind of gold standard ways of thinking, but with these different disruptive technologies and disruptive concepts, really building better for the future, I think, is an exciting thing.
Yeah, I think it's a lot of mind shift changing at the moment with things, right? When I first got into it, I think people sometimes use the analogy, especially with testing, it's like, you know, think of it as a house. You're just checking the perimeters, making sure your gates locked, your doors locked, your windows locked, and stuff like that. But actually thinking from inside out, like, is everything in here secure, you know? And right. Then working your way outwards just seems a lot more logical when you think about it like that. But
yeah,
but it's always been the case of, okay, well, as long as the perimeter is safe, then whatever's going on in the middle, it could be madness, who cares, but as long as outside's done. But, you know, as you say, as all these breaches have happened, all these incidents, all the bits of news coming up, and all people sharing what's happened, trying to plug those holes, it makes sense of, okay, why are we plugging all the holes when we should really be thinking, why do those holes kind of generated in the first place, right? So we did a lot of stuff before around trying to move security left with some of the banks I worked with in the past. And that was like, you know, from a testing perspective, just because obviously Pendus people support this, from a testing perspective, instead of kind of testing at the end of a development or a product release or whatever, you know, start at the beginning, or start where you start looking at things and start, you know, testing little bits as you go through to make sure that it's secure from the start, versus just put something together and then someone else can fix the holes and then we can ship it out. It's actually, you know, how can we just do things a little bit better?
And even, exactly. And pen testing as a service or you know, continual pen testing, even that's, you know, a relatively new concept. Pen testing's been around for, you know, however long. But that notion that let's not just do it as a box tick point in time. Okay, I know it was secure yesterday, but is it still secure today? Mm-hmm. That notion of integrating that more into the development lifecycle in a sort of almost an agile way, repeatable agile way, again is a positive step forward.
Yeah, I think it gets to a point where industries and things have to change, and we're definitely seeing that. And I'm seeing it in the pen testing world. Like when I kind of left, people just doing pen tests and reports and send them off in zip files and stuff. It's like, why are you doing that? Why is it not in one place? Why is it not like a dashboard sort of thing where you can view stuff and you can check against other bits, which is a good thing. And then why are we working with someone and doing pen testing, and then we're going and selling them vulnerability scanning, etc., alongside it. It's just like, this is all part of a, you know, there is a problem, and it takes multiple things to solve that problem. It makes sense for it to be in one place, but I think potentially the growth of the industry is just driving some consolidation as well, which sounds like it's innovation, but it's really, well, why have all of these things where you can just have one thing? And I remember people saying technology fatigue was becoming quite a thing, right? Because everyone and the dog has got a new technology come out of new flashy lights. You know, how do they work together? Are the right tech stacks in place? And are you using the right tools for the outcome, or have you just kind of banded some stuff together hoping that it will work?
Yeah. And also probably just worth saying that, I mean, things like, again, despite Zero Trust being this great thing, it's going to be very hard for some industries or some organizations to implement it, right? If you've got a particularly old legacy tech stack supporting on-prem, cloud, this, that, the other. If you're starting out greenfield with a blank sheet of paper or a blank Terraform script, then happy days. You know, you've got the tools and the support to do it really, really well. It's obviously more difficult retrofitting to a more legacy environment.
Totally agree.
I was just going to say, the lights in this room just dimmed. Can you still see me okay?
Yeah, it's fine.
I'm obviously not moving around quite enough. Cool. As long as it's still fine, good. Happy to.
Yeah, it's exactly the same all the way through for myself, so I've not really noticed anything. So maybe the screen is kind of adapted to it.
Brilliant. Probably best, actually, the darker it is. Oh, there we go.
there we go. It did happen. Now it's back on.
Right.
Your last person in the office.
Terrible work ethic.
Yeah. Let me just kind of pick up where we were. So, my brain's gone a little bit now. So I was going to say on that point, you can only kind of really do what is best for the business, right? Like I've been to a lot of events, and you know, spending the years doing this, some events to go to, you see that kind of ambulance chasing, you know, use this story, use that story to go and get budget and stuff like that. And you know, certain CISOs and technology leaders, etc., will have like what they would love to have, but what they'd love to have versus what is relevant and what's and you've got to find that merge for yourself personally to align to that, and then work with the business to make sure like you are going on that journey and just, to as you say, doing what you can. Not every business can start with a green sheet, can they? So,
without a doubt, and equally, you know, chasing after all the latest tools and the newest things, that can be really detrimental. And the more complicated your stack is, the more, you know, the noise to signal ratio is all wrong. And if you're, you know, you mentioned alert fatigue, or you know, if you have teams constantly chasing after alerts that are ultimately not important, or duplicated or whatever it may be, that's really not a good place to be. So it's I think it's important for CISOs to bear that in mind and build the right, as you say, the right kind of set of tooling and the right options for their business, and only they'll know what that is.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of, one of the main things I thought was quite exciting about this, and you know, working with a lot of enterprise companies over my career, you know, start small and start working up, ended up working lots of banks and lots of kind of enterprise FTSE companies and Fortune companies. When you get to a certain size, you then end up having effectively a CISO function that then like acts as a business unit that then supports the rest of the business. I'd love to, you know, get your thoughts on that and how it's kind of worked for you over the years, and where there's kind of like crossover and you know, how it works well, and yeah, any kind of like, any insight you can share from that side, because I think as these the people who are listening, as you go in a kind of journey, even as a CISO, you work in a business where there's just that one business, and then you'll go to another one that's got multiple businesses underneath it, and then it becomes into that function. It's a learning, you know, evolution over a period of time. So
yeah,
for sure. your kind of like first hand insights on working with that function.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Because it, you know, it's a subject that I am passionate about very much. But today and throughout my career, it's never been my primary responsibility. As you say, I've always worked with, and I do today work with, a central CISO-led InfoSec team or AppSec and the various flavors within it. Mm-hmm. So I see myself much more as a kind of a consumer or a client of of an InfoSec team, rather than, I guess, many of your guests that come on are, you know, they are the focal point, or they're the ones that are setting that strategy. And so hopefully, yeah, I can offer maybe a little bit of a different perspective and some ideas of where I think I've seen good things from our team, and how, you know, I as a customer take their output and help my teams then make sure that they implement it correctly. I think one thing that is key, and isn't maybe always the most natural thing for somebody that works in InfoSec, please don't at me, and hopefully I'm not going to offend anyone, but security professionals, I think, really, and particularly the CISO, really need to be storytellers, right? They need to be able to communicate the value, not just to, you know, the exec team and the board, but also, you know, your regular product or engineering teams. You want people to be bought in, you want people to be engaged, you want to shift left and drive, you know, a lot more of that work earlier in the process. And obviously you can do that with guardrails and rules and, you know, the sort of the stick.
Yeah.
But I do think a carrot is a much better approach. And so, you know, soft skills within that function and the ability to tell the story, explain the value, share stories and experience and whatnot, I think is incredibly valuable, incredibly important. So that would be maybe as a takeaway for some of your watchers or your listeners. I think that's, if that isn't an area where you feel strong and feel it's your kind of natural sweet spot, then that's something to invest some personal growth in. I think having that that ability to communicate, to be a storyteller, to sell the value.
Yeah, we were kind of saying earlier on that from when you look at the evolution of the role in the industry, it's very much been kind of stick focused, right, versus carrot. Like, lots of companies who would really do security things was because they had to do it because there was a governance, there was a
tick box. Yep.
A client says, if you don't have this, then we're not working with you. And then does that then drive the culture and the mindset within that function to be a bit stick driven as well? Whereas actually, like, you've got to take that stick kind of like forcing that company to go in that direction and then turn it around into a positive. And, you know, all the way over the years, I've seen the conversations around, oh yeah, we're a cost center, and, you know, it's very much, we've got to do this, or security are kind of telling us to X, Y, and Z, and it's just getting in the way of us doing business and all the other things. It's then how you then become that person who is turning that, you know, that negative driver, if you will. If that's an okay way to explain it, in my head it makes sense. But to then flip it and say, okay, well, okay, I get all the reasons why things are going this way, and I'm not going to go there and say, hey, you know, ambulance chase and be like, you must do this, or you have to do this, and you know, smacking that stick on the table. Actually, more trying to then turn that around to then communicate that out in a bit of a positive way that then aligns to different people, because, you know, there's different personality types that all have to consume this information, from tech to legal to, you know, frontline customer service, etc., that need to understand this in a positive way versus being told off, because people being told off or being told what to do don't really react as well as they would do if you're telling them a story and kind of like getting the buy-in and the passion from their side as well.
Yeah. And I think particularly with, out of all the C-level roles, and again, this is probably a very broad statement, tarring everyone with the same brush, but of all the C-level roles, it's probably the one where you would see the most hardcore technical members of the team kind of elevate and grow into that position. You know, they've come from quite often, not always, clearly, but always been quite a hands-on tech, security-focused individual. Mm-hmm. So having those skills, having those soft skills to be able to negotiate, to convince, to persuade, to sell, isn't always going to be the most natural thing.
Mm. And so I think from both sides, it's how do you bridge that gap? And I guess maybe from your side, as you're kind of engaging with those people, like, how do you kind of help them get that story across as well? Because sometimes you can be working with someone, and you know, like, okay, they're really passionate about something, they're really trying to get something across, but it's just coming across all wrong. How do I how to kind of help them reframe that a little bit so that I can understand it a bit better and I can buy into it, because I kind of see why we should, but if it was done in a different way, it would be better for you, but then it would also be better for, you know, everyone else who they'll be going and talking to on a daily basis.
I think it's a general tool to use to craft your messaging. It's about helping people understand the value in what you're asking them to do. And although the end goal of that might be the same for everyone, the journey is going to be different. Mm-hmm. So if I'm in front of the board or the exec team telling them why I need X million dollars to go and buy some tool, then they're going to want to know about, you know, ROI. They're going to want to know about, you know, bottom line impact and what I think I might save in terms of hours that my security team spend on something or whatever. So they're going to want to see it massaged or presented in a particular way. Mm-hmm. But then if I'm out trying to encourage a product team to use my walled path of security tools, it's going to save you X amount of time. You know, when you get to deployment, it's going to, you know, streamline your releases. You can automate it. You can build it into your pipelines. You know, so it's ultimately, you know, it's one set of inputs or one set of asks, but then a different set of outputs depending on who you're trying to persuade. Yeah. So just like think about the audience, think about how to best explain the value to them, even if you're talking about the same thing, ultimately.
Well, kind of what's most important to them, right? And that's only really done by asking and talking and getting to know those people versus, you know, just going out with a standard message across.
Yeah, for sure. And I think part of that, so then that leads me into my next point, I think, which is everyone needs to be bought into it. I absolutely love the terminology around the human firewall, right? I love, because what I then picture in my mind is all my colleagues, all my workmates, us all kind of linking arms and standing around, you know, around the building, around their data centers or whatever it may be. And we're only as strong as each individual, you know, link in that chain.
Yeah.
So
I'm thinking from your zero trust bit around all different assets and then one around the outside and the inside as well.
Yeah, exactly that. So I, you know, I could have all the endpoint detection and all the WAFs and all the everything in the world, but if my colleague in sales or in procurement or, you know, some other team clicks on a bad link, a phishing email or whatever it may be, and or malware, you know, then we can be in trouble. So that notion of everyone in it together, security being a shared responsibility, regardless of the team that you're in and the business unit or the P&L that you're in, like, it's all our responsibility. And it comes back to that messaging point, that communication, making the training, because there'll be some training and certification that we need to do, and that's a good thing, but making that as interesting as it can be, making it accessible, making it as fun as you can make it, I think is important.
I think that last part, making it fun is great, like, you know, making sure you're telling the right story, making sure it's fun, and kind of banding together you know, within a business and also within an industry or kind of a collective. I think that's a lot of things that I'm hearing for these chats with CISOs and technology and security industry leaders. These things come out time and time again of like, share more, support more, work together, you know, collaborate, communicate in the best way that matches everyone, because, you know, sometimes a person in one area speaking to someone in another area, that it's completely different because of the way that they think and the way they communicate. It's just then, right, it's great to be you in your bubble, but then when you're kind of accessed open, how can you let the rest in, if that makes sense?
Absolutely. And that sort of leads me into the next thing I wanted to mention, which I thought is a positive and a powerful thing that the InfoSec team have driven here at Morningstar, and that's the notion of security champions. And that is a concept where individuals are embedded into teams, or existing members of teams become security champions. And that might be because it's something that they have a real strong interest in. It might be just a good stretch thing for them, which is also good. Or they might have just been voluntold that, you know, you are going to be the security champion.
I'll come along with a fire marshal jacket. Like, that's
yeah, get the high vis on. But the,
it's empowering for those things. I've worked with companies before where they've put those bits in place, and people are like, unless you start going around and asking people about it and educating people, you wouldn't know that whoever in the corner over there would love to be a security champion, but no one's even had that. And actually, that's a really, you know, important asset as part of that human firewall that could just be sat there for years. Just
definitely. And actually, that's a good, you've reminded me of a good learning that I've had in my career, which is don't always assume that a job that you wouldn't have fancied, or you think, oh, that's a shitty job, I'll do it myself. Don't assume that somebody in your team doesn't want to do that job. They might be desperate to do that job. They might really enjoy that job.
Yeah.
So just don't assume that because you sort of think, oh, I'm going to do it because nobody else will want to do it. Don't make that assumption. Offer it out. For that champion is quite a defined set of roles and responsibilities. It can be things like, you know, obviously, as the name suggests, being the champion of the security function within the team. But it also means, you know, there's a community or a guild that's built out around that. Their role is to be the conduit of all the information and requests that are coming down from the central team. Mm-hmm. You know, the sort of training responsibilities in terms of upskilling yourself, but also making sure that your fellow members of your team are training. It's sort of safeguarding the practices and the processes that the InfoSec team are asking teams to do, so that when it gets to, you know, a kind of hopefully a belt and braces security check before going live with something, you've already done the things that, you know, nothing should be a surprise because your security champion has made sure that, you know, you've done your various testing or your static analysis or whatever it is before, you know, and the dynamic testing is already in place by the time you get to going live. So it's like having a member of the InfoSec team in every product team across the organization, which obviously wouldn't scale to have an actual member of the team. So but we have the next best thing in these champions. So that's a structure that I think has worked really, really well. And it also helps with that kind of messaging and communication piece that we talked about.
Yeah, I think when you get bigger, I think even smaller companies having champions is a great idea. But I think when you get to a certain size, you can only do so much as a function. Then you need you need supporters kind of out there to help you achieve what you're looking to achieve.
No doubt. And then the final thing that I think has worked well for us here, again, something coming out of the central team, is, I suppose you could call it the gamification of security and actually resiliency as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So each team gets what's called a product scorecard. And this ultimately comes out as a rating, a number of stars out of five. That is reflective of, a raft of things. But for example, number of open static analysis vulnerabilities and the age of one of the most critical ones, and so on and so forth. Things like your last, you know, when was your last DR test? Are you, you know, is your DR documentation up to date on the frequency that we expect? And then it's developed into some, it's kind of iterated on over time. And so now it's things like within my account within our cloud provider, have I got long running instances that maybe are over a month old and therefore maybe don't have the latest patching or latest images or whatever it may be. So from that, you get a good for the leadership. It's a really nice and easy to digest window into or lens into the state of that particular team. But then what's kind of interesting is from an individual team point of view, you get to see everyone else's as well. So there's that little bit of competition almost that gets introduced, that gamification. Yeah.
you it can makes build... it a bit more fun when you're doing stuff like that, right? Because
it does.
Everyone likes a little bit of competition, and you know, extreme cases is cases maybe not, but yeah, that's so. I think when what we do, kind of sorry to bring it back a little bit, but about what we do from Pendistoners as a service on the product, they you have all these different kind of business units that can kind of see where they are, and you, we have companies that are kind of, you know, we're here and we're I don't know, gold, silver, bronze, or whatever. We're at different levels, and actually now we're on this bit. Now we're on this bit. Right. Or, you know, we're doing better than so and so. And it doesn't become like that negative, like, oh, you know, you're terrible leaderboard. Who's one at the bottom? It's more like a fun, as you say, like kind of gamify and make it a little bit more enjoyable. Yeah. Like, okay, well, you know, I was fourth last month. I was literally off. I'm going to be third next month. I'm going to put a little bit more effort or get the team to focus a little bit more over here to kind of move that up. And
it's
helping other people as well, because they'll be like, oh, Neil's now like rising through the ranks. Like, what are we going to do? We need to step up.
Exactly. Yeah. And it gives, you know, leaders of the different areas sort of saying, okay, well, I know that this team is doing okay. This one of my teams is doing okay. This one obviously needs a little bit more help. Maybe I need to move resource around, add resource, swap the security champions, whatever it may be. And then you can also use it to build, you know, whether it's goals or OKRs or what, you know, whatever sort of metric and tool that you use within your organization, you can build tracking around it to say, okay, well, you know, going into Q2, we were a 3 on the scorecard. You know, by the end of Q3, let's get up to 4 stars or whatever, you know, whatever it may be, and build some targets and some actionable goals around that. So that I think has worked really well. A really nice tool. Maybe people can think about that.
Yeah, really like that. I'm going to go on to the last question. I don't want to keep you too long, but what would your advice be to people, you know, coming into industry? It doesn't have to be obviously CISO related. Like, what advice would you kind of give? Or the other kind of lens that we give on this is, you know, if you were to send a postcard to yourself 10 years ago, what would the bit of advice be? Which is always quite interesting to see what people come up with.
So that I think there's one that's probably two bits of advice. One is very generic, I suppose, that does apply to anyone, CISO or anyone in tech or anyone in anything probably. And then maybe one that's a little more CISO specific. But the generic sounds a terrible way. It's not generic. It's but anyway, broadly applicable is what I mean.
Is
be curious. Be insatiably curious. Like, if I think one of my strongest traits, one of the reasons I've been successful in my career, is just being probably annoyingly curious. Like, I hate not understanding something. I hate not knowing how something works. If there's been an outage, I hate not knowing exactly why it came to be and what we could have done differently. And, oh, that was weird, we had this error, now it's cleared, but why, what was the error, how did it happen, is it going to come again, was it a narrow escape? It's just, I would say that to anyone in any field of technology, be curious. Mm-hmm. And actually bringing it back to InfoSec, and I even wrote his name down because I would have forgotten it otherwise, but recently with the very near, very serious breach around XZUtils, the chap that works on Postgres called Andres Frund, who discovered this like very elaborate multi-year exploit attempt.
Oh, wow.
To embed a backdoor into XZUtils, was discovered ultimately by Andres Frund being curious, using a third-party library, seeing some odd errors that he didn't recognize, it taking longer than it used to take in a previous version. Mm-hmm. And he was like, I want to understand this, dug into it, and ultimately discovered this vulnerability and prevented what would have been a fairly dramatic, wide-reaching exploit. So, be curious. And it'll be a long way.
What makes work a bit more fun as well, I think, on that side of... I did some training with a large payment company a while back, more sales training with the different teams, and the whole thing was like, be curious was our kind of tagline hashtag.
All right.
And it just, when you started seeing people thinking a bit more curious, they feel like I think naturally as a human, we are, we're problem solvers, we're curious, we're interested. I think sometimes when you go to work, you just kind of then become the work you, which doesn't have that level of curiosity. Then see people, see it kind of like going into people's work and their lights kind of come on, they become more passionate, and they're actually like, they start livening up a bit more because they're like, start asking more and figuring stuff out, and they're getting the joys of that as well as the, you know, the other bits that they get in work. So yeah, I really love that.
And I actually, at a sort of purely base level, it can open avenues and doors and opportunities for you. Like if I'm like, I'd really love to know a little bit more about your team and how your product works, or, you know, this dependency that I have in my product, I'd like to kind of understand more about how it works, and so that I have a, you know, better understanding of my product. And then you might think, oh, actually, I really like that team. Maybe that's a team I want to go in, or that's an area that I want to work in. Or they might think, actually, this guy's really good, I want him in my team.
Yeah.
So, you know, just it can, apart from it being just a really good tool for you to educate yourself and grow, it can actually open career doors and career opportunities for you as well. So, yeah, be curious. Hashtag be curious is my new, that'll be my new.
I think it's gone enough time that I can use that now. But
yeah, no copyright issues.
Yeah, but it's cool, and it's back to that kind of point of like, you know, you never know what that person in the corner may be wanting to do unless you engage with them. Or if, you know, if you're being curious, then you're kind of driving that engagement that then can help other people as well. So being curious is not just a selfish thing to utilize to you know, get more opportunities and to,
absolutely,
you know, not serve yourself. It helps other people be curious as well.
And then I think that my advice to specifically around security and to a aspiring CISO and an aspiring security leader is to know your business, understand your business. And by that I mean the reality being that the CISO community work incredibly hard and do their best, but it's an almost impossible task because of infinite resource and time and in the hands of bad actors. So securing everything and being 100% shipshape across every aspect and vector that your business is facing is very, very difficult. But if you know your business, if you understand your business, if you know what's important, if you know what the most valuable assets are, whether that's, you know, your reputation or your data or whatever it may be, focus on that, secure that, prioritize that, and then, you know, make sure that you're not just secure but resilient to attacks on those assets. And that will be different to every single business, and only the CISO will know what is right for that particular business. And that comes from speaking to your stakeholders, speaking with your board or your exec team, and understanding what is critical.
I think speaking to peers as well and getting people to advise and support as well. Like as you say, find as many kind of touch points you can to gather that information and then make that relevant to the business.
Absolutely. And that will stand you in good stead, I think.
I was talking to, you mentioned a few things. I don't know if you know Vicky Gavin. She was the CISO of, I think she was actually at the NHS now, but she was CISO of Economist a while back. So she was really on to the human firewall part. But she was also, my brain's just gone, sorry. what was the last point? So the human firewall part, and God, I'm really sorry. What was the last point we just mentioned?
About just touch points, understanding the assets that are valuable to your specific business.
Yeah. So I don't know if you know Vicky Gavin, but she was the CISO of the Economist. One thing she mentioned was that understanding your business, which is, you know, making sure that you have the right touch points, but being able to communicate to the business, and actually some CISO roles are becoming more business focused than they are technology focused, because it's actually more important to really understand the business and then connect those two different languages or those two kind of entities together than it is to, you know, to be the, you know, wanting everything 100% perfect.
Right.
It's actually understanding what's relevant for the business. And then what you can do to put what's right for that business at the right time. I remember I was working for a chief revenue officer at one point, and I was working on the certain, you know, change initiative with him. I really wanted to do X, Y, and Z and all these great things. And his kind of point come back to me is like, you're right, but do you think the business is ready for that right now? Or do you think we should probably, that's maybe 18 months from now, but we can then start step by step by step getting to that journey. And yeah, just when you're really passionate, you're gung-ho and you're wanting to go ahead, sometimes you're like, okay, well, that's really good to understand. It's what's relevant for the business right now versus what I'd love to do.
For sure. For sure. And that ties nicely back to the whole communication storytelling piece that we touched on earlier as well. Having the right answers to the right questions about what's important, getting that information and being able to communicate back in terms of this is what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Those soft skills are really, really important these days.
Yeah. Totally agree. Well, thank you very much for sharing your advice and your thoughts and kind of explaining the, you know, your concept or how you engage with security as a CTO. I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much, Neil, for joining us on this podcast. And hopefully we can have you back again at some point. Hopefully we can meet in person one day.
Yeah, that'd be great. Very much enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. And for our guests, you know, keep tuned for the next podcast coming out.